The following episode is with David Shenker, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs and a current fellow and expert at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Our discussion covers his latest piece, Changing the Israel-Lebanon Status Quo, U.S. Options.
I still believe that Hezbollah, for a number of reasons, but the lead reason being because its masters in Tehran don't want it, is that they will not go to a full-scale war voluntarily. But this is an asset for Iran, and it's meant to deter Israel from striking the Iranian regime or the nuclear program. It is not there to liberate Lebanon. It's not there to go to Jerusalem. It is there to protect Iran. And so Damascus strike by Israel, the most significant killing of a Quds Force official since Qasem Soleimani. There will be retaliation anticipated right after the Eid. The question is how Iran does it and what Hezbollah does. And, there are a lot of people like myself who see Hezbollah as a tool of Iran. And if Hezbollah goes to war and participates in this retaliation, I think they'll just prove how much of a tool they are of Iran. Basically bringing Lebanon into another war in the service of Tehran. This, of course, would be disastrous, not only for Lebanon, for Israel as well, for the region. But these are, decisions that will be made. I tend to think it's not going to happen like that, but it could very well happen. And I am not optimistic in any event, even if we can avoid this. We get a ceasefire in Gaza, we de-escalate temporarily. I somehow feel there is a certain level of inevitability about the next war between Israel and Hezbollah.
In your estimate, is there any conversation happening about how to prevent that vis-a-vis Lebanese authorities? And the reason I'm trying to bring it to Lebanon here is that my memory of how 1701 was put together, at least on the Lebanese side, was that there was a political momentum here that was willing to go a certain direction and how to implement something like 1701 without Chapter 7 effect, meaning that UNIFIL cannot take any actions without Lebanese government coordination. And it's hard for me to see a Lebanese actor today that is best prepared to take that kind of role on, which means to a degree, some confrontation with Hezbollah's interests in the South. And that also by extension means some form of diplomacy with Iran that Lebanon doesn't have. So do you sense that there is a Lebanese actor or the potential for one to actually help, whether it's through UNIFIL expansion or whether it's through the Lebanese army and numbers increasing in the South? Is that a prerequisite to at least prevent what could be a war in the near term?
Well, I think it is perhaps postponing the inevitable. Better jaw than war, right? Was that Churchill? If you can find a modus vivendi for a year, I think that would be, certainly beneficial. But yeah, Hochstein is working on this plan have UNIFIL augmented by maybe some bilateral French, German observers who are more neutral and maybe willing actually to call balls and strikes. UNIFIL, I think, is risk averse, the product of getting bombed and killed, attacked by Hezbollah all the time. There's only a certain amount they will do. They won't be confrontational. We saw what happened when they tried once to employ drones in the South, even for force protection. Yeah. And then, of course, Hochstein is trying to get UNIFIL down to the South, trying to sweeten the pot, offering perhaps to pay salaries of this, defunct, financially strapped military because of the financial crisis. That may be helpful, but we still have the the problem with the monitor and whether Hezbollah will abide by this, right? Whether they will willingly move Radwan forces back the 7 to 10 kilometers that will allow, you know, the 80,000 Israelis to return to their homes in northern Israel, the Lebanese, you know, 50 to 80,000 from South Lebanon to return to their homes. And then, you know, to engage in some sort of discussions on the blue line. Now, I don't think, you know, the administration, I think, is holding that out somehow as something that is an incentive for Hezbollah to engage. I don't really think they want to come to an agreement on the blue line, right? They don't want to end the so-called occupation. So this is not something that I think they could pocket. Question is whether they're willing to live with their Radwan forces pulled back and perhaps, you know, no Israeli drones flying over on a daily basis, but perhaps UNIFIL drones. And that, I don't have the answer to that question. I find it sort of hard to believe. You know, Hezbollah cheats. They cheated last time. These people, there were 10, 12,000 of them on the border ready to do what Hamas did to Israel on October 7th.
And I share the sentiment of the piece that a permanent solution, meaning a full implementation of what could be an extended ceasefire and a blue line demarcation, is part of that. And that kind of stability in the south, to me, also doesn't seem plausible if Hezbollah is to at least retain some form of legitimacy for their sub-state arsenal. At the same time, it's the same person. I always don't know how to pronounce his last name. Is it
Hochstein?
Hochstein. Hochstein was able to at least produce something offshore and maritime border demarcation that was with Hezbollah's at least indirect oversight. Do you think that that kind of situation could evolve should other factors take course as a prerequisite, meaning, and this comes out in the piece, an emphasis on trying to offer gains to the south that in a way make Hezbollah's presence less popular? And that could be through economic activity. That could even be through the Lebanese army taking a more visible role, where that southerners feel less vulnerable by default, and perhaps they have more to lose in a future war. Is that the kind of prerequisite needed, at least, to have something that is more sustainable to prevent another round of war?
Well, I think that's what Hochstein envisions, that and why he was so, I think, committed to the maritime. You know, if both Lebanon and Hezbollah are invested, there's a chance to make some money. Lebanon is, you know, amidst this financial crisis, if there's this opportunity of $2 billion or more in natural gas, to get this deal would sort of link Israeli economic interests to Lebanese economic interests and would foster peace and security and stability. You know, I don't think that's really come to pass on the maritime. You know, putting aside whether Lebanon actually has any natural gas,
right?
You know, yeah. I don't think it provided any security. And that was one of the selling points, I think, of the agreement that both Hochstein and the Israeli government made to the Israeli public. But, you know, the investment in the South, Hochstein sees it exactly the way you portray it, which is you build up the South, there's more to lose. People are invested in their future. There's less of a appeal of Hezbollah's culture of death. Ultimately, that would be helpful. But, you know, I think Lokman once told me the story of somebody who tried to open an apple juice factory in the South, which would provide employment and economic opportunity for the people. And, of course, you know, less dependence on the resistance, right, the so-called resistance. And Hezbollah and its pals shut it down, right? This was never allowed to operate because Hezbollah sees little interest in having economic prosperity in the South. They want a dependent, quiescent, subservient, I think, constituency.
And that kind of scenario where there are default difficulties to providing any alternative to what has become a very robust well-honed and also financially stable sub-state autonomy. Is there any inclination when these negotiations happen? It could be with Amos Hochstein, touring the region, and it could even be in regional capitals where the U.S. does at least pay attention to what's being discussed. Are there any indirect channels to Hezbollah's sponsor, to Iran, and how to at least temporarily de-escalate the South? As far as you know, are there any discussions happening on Lebanon's behalf?
Well, I don't have amazing ties. It may surprise you. I don't have amazing ties in this administration. Hochstein is a smart guy. I got to give him that. I have some, fundamental disagreements, but he's a very smart guy. And I'm sure he's engaging with regional capitals. I mean, you know, when you talk back channels, it's not just, the Qataris who speak to the Iranians. They share a natural gas field in the Arabian Gulf. But, you saw the Hezbollah just went to the UAE, right? I mean, there's a lot of potential channels. A lot of people talk to the Iranians. Mm-hmm. The United States can talk to the Iranians if they want to, directly or indirectly. We message them, we see back and forths now on holding America responsible for the Damascus attack, et cetera, the warnings being sent back and forth publicly. But, I don't think we have the same kind of amazing tight connections we had when Rob Malley was the point man on this, right? But I still think there is, a way to communicate with them to deconflict or try to avoid a worst case scenario.
Have you ever experienced something that is close to that, meaning there is a shared interest in de-escalation in Lebanon? Not necessarily the full implementation of 1701, but in your wider career, have you sensed that Iran does listen or at least has something to offer when it comes to Hezbollah in Lebanon? And the reason I'm asking it this way is because I do sense over time that when dignitaries or diplomats visit Lebanese politicians today, this is more for photography or photo ops or even social media. It may not be for politics, not to discredit the individuals that he recently met. But I do sense that Amos Hochstein's recent visits are less Lebanese involvement per se and more just placating concerns. And these tend to be almost conspiratorial at times in Lebanon, that the Americans are abandoning or that a deal's on the horizon that's going to destroy the country and make it permanently collapsed. I sense it's more that rather than real diplomacy, at least when it comes to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Am I reading it right, or is there anything you can offer on that?
Well, I mean, notwithstanding people like Nabi Berri who say we will not allow Lebanon to slip into a war, I mean, this guy's own fighters are firing rockets at Israel, right? And he's getting whacked. These politicians, with the exception of maybe Berri, have limited impact and have no impact on the sovereign portfolios of Lebanon, right? Whether this is, Mikati said it, I don't decide on matters of war and peace.
Yeah.
Still, he has something to say about this, Speaker of Parliament has something to say, the Prime Minister, if you had a president, he might have something to say. But none of it, I think, really impactful, as you note. I mean, I think when I look at somebody like Hochstein's visits, I look to see whether he's going to see Abbas Ibrahim. This is how he's engaging, basically through a mediator to Hezbollah.
And that kind of, when those visits are happening and there's at least the inclination to see some kind of deal on the horizon, is it fair to suggest at this point that 1701 over time becomes more an aspiration rather than a implemented Security Council resolution? And the reason I frame it this way is the 7 to 10 kilometer readjustment, let's say, of Hezbollah fighters, to me sounds like progress today, but it's still a far cry from 1701. Has that become fait accompli that we're not going to see that kind of scenario, at least on the in the near term?
Yeah, I think what they're looking for are elements of 1701 or 1701 light, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
There's a realization not only that, you know, there's going to be Radwan forces that are forward of that line because maybe they live there,
mm-hmm.
right? But are they going and visiting their bases? Are they, you know, are they wearing uniforms? Are they carrying weapons? There's a certain amount of this, I think, that will be ultimately tolerated. But the fact that, you know, we flooded the zone with 15,000, up to 15,000, the top number got to like 13,500, a cap of 15,000 UNIFIL in, you know, South Lebanon, that is, as I note in the piece, you know, more peacekeepers per kilometer
right.
than anywhere else in the world. And still, since 1982, okay, granted, they only had 1,800 people back then until, you know, 2006. Since then, I think they only found one weapon, right? Like one arm shipment, and that was at sea. How could this happen? So, you know, whether this even makes sense, right, to have these people there at that high level of deployment, but they weren't going to be effective, right? Because it's not under the right authority. They respect what's called private property, which is Green Without Borders, Hezbollah military bases. They couldn't go see the tunnels that were flooded from Israel's side, you know, that were the concrete flowing out in the village. And, you know, adding to this, and I don't mean to malign the LAF, although I must say the statement today that said that, you know, that Haskal was killed by kidnapped Syrian kidnappers and the LAF backing that up, it really is not a good look for the LAF. But the fact that over the years and documented by UNIFIL that the LAF has actually obstructed UNIFIL from going to certain sites, actively colluded, coordinated with Hezbollah to prevent UNIFIL from doing its job, you know, that doesn't really bode well for the implementation of 1701 either. And finally, just one last point, I don't want to drone on here, speaking of drones,
I was going to say that's the perfect segue.
So the Israelis are still flying, and never mind the overflights that they're doing to whack Hezbollah, right? The Hezbollah started it, but the drone flights over the south, I'm not even sure that if there is a de-escalation, that Israel would accede to stopping those drone overflights just because there's been so much cheating in the past. Now, maybe if UNIFIL was flying drones, that would be another story. But, you know, this is complicated. And there's a lot of several parties that got to do several things. And it's all got to start with Hezbollah acquiescence to this. And I'm not really, you know, particularly optimistic that we're going to get there.
I hear it, and I'm not sure if I'm hearing it right, that this is just stalling at best. But that war is coming, and that Israel will not tolerate that kind of infrastructure on the border again, especially post October 7. Am I reading it right in that more very bleak assertion that this is an inevitable conclusion, that war is coming?
Well, you know, Rania, what's inevitable? You know the saying, death and taxes. Nothing is inevitable, but it looks pretty bleak. You know, Hezbollah, backed by Iran, is committed to certain things, whether this is harassment, preparation, deterrence, whether they can do that from 7 kilometers away, whether this is a problem for them. But the certainty is that no Israel government will accept the situation of October 6th. On the border with the north. You know, it's going to take, you know, probably a decade for all the Israelis to move back north, right? It is emptied out. And this was a major, not only agricultural center, but economic center for Israel. the whole Galil, the north, Matola, and then, you know, all the way across to, you know, Rosh Nikra and Nakora area. So for these people to feel safe and not have a 70,000 Israeli Defense Forces deployment along that border, which is not really sustainable in the long term for an army of 180,000 in Israel, it's going to have to change. So is it inevitable? No. But it can be postponed. But, you know, Hezbollah gets a vote here. Iran gets a vote here. There's a lot of public pressure, you know, more pressure on the hostages. But second, you know, 80,000 people is a lot of people in a country of, you know, what, 9 million, something like this. So where they go from here, you know, I don't think it's a red line, right? I don't think there's a lot of people talking about war this summer. You know, war is, you know, people packing their bags again in South Lebanon, leaving them at the door. I don't think we're there. You know, it's going to be increasingly tense going forward. And I think if there isn't war and there isn't some sort of modus, new sort of status quo, I think what we're going to see is a long-term sort of new Israeli concept of operations in Lebanon that resembles how they've been operating for the past decade or so in Syria. That is, you hit something, you see something, you hit it. And if there's retaliation, there's retaliation, but they're going to, you know, draw some guidelines and just go after it, because UNIFIL is not going to call balls and strikes. And maybe if the Germans are on the ground, the Israelis will trust them. The French maybe a little bit less so because of their abiding, you know, desire for stability over anything else in Lebanon. But it, you know, maybe it can be postponed.
My memory of July 2006, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is an Israeli eagerness to go further into Lebanon and be more active in destroying Hezbollah or dismantling their capabilities in a way that is convincing for them. And by the second or third week of that war, it's American pressure that creates a ceasefire and a conclusion to that war. And now we look back on it as 1701, but that America is heavily involved in persuading Israel not to go further. And you can correct me here as well if I'm wrong. Perhaps the second week of October 2023, or the third week, a week after October 7, it is also American disinterest in having war spill out to a degree that Lebanon is sucked in vis-a-vis Hezbollah, and that you could have a regional war that spirals. It's American pressure that pushes Israel to reconsider those what could be exactly what we're talking about, which is the eagerness to hit Hezbollah harder. Is that a correct assessment, that it's American pressure that's preventing more war right now?
Well, actually, I read 2006 a little differently. I think Israel hadn't done its homework sufficiently before it went in on the ground. As you recall, the first 10 days of the war, you remember the WikiLeaks with Nabi Berri.
Yeah.
They call it the Malat Asam, you know, like, you know, Israel has to take their time with Hezbollah, you know, give them more time to whack Hezbollah. But then they ran out of targets and they started hitting bridges in Junya, right? And then the oil at the Beirut airport and doing environmental damage. And Lebanese said, why are we being punished? Why do they hate us? And I think Israel spent the last, what, how many years since 2006, basically doing their homework. And you can see it, the way they're operating, what they're hitting in South Lebanon, right? But when they went in the ground back in 2006, they were ill-prepared. They didn't have the logistics. You know, they were being caught up in ambushes, et cetera. It's tough terrain, tough fighters, you know, tough campaign. And they didn't do particularly well. And I think 1701 actually was, beneficial, good for Lebanon, good for Israel. And we had, what, 17 years of peace after that? Israel said, oh, we had deterrence. I'm not sure that was the case, but we had a regimen that everyone believed was working well enough. 2023, I think you're right. The administration really put pressure on Israel. And there were some in Israel, although not all, who said, we should, we're started, we should go. Let's just go against Hezbollah. But I think calmer heads prevailed, which is, do we really want a two-state war? And look, I mean, and that proved to be the right decision, right? No regional war, no war with another state. Harassment from the Hashid, harassment from the Houthis, harassment from Hezbollah, but nothing strategic at this point. And I think, I think the Israelis are, it's a vindication for Washington. Israel's 6 months into this war in Gaza, and they still haven't reached their objective, right? The release of the hostages and, the cleaning out of the last three brigades in Rafah, the end of Hamas rule. So it makes sense that they didn't do it. I think, some of this was pressure and some of it was sage advice.
Beyond what Lebanese actors are doing at the moment, whether it's an opposition bloc that is trying to channel the preference for no war and the implementation of 1701, and that's become standard language among Lebanon's opposition, opposition meaning opposition to Hezbollah. Beyond that communication, beyond that outreach, beyond the occasional visits to Washington, D.C., beyond what the Lebanese state does provide at the moment, and that does include the Lebanese army, what the Lebanese army is capable of doing and willing to do. Do you see anything, any opportunities being missed when it comes to this crowd? Is there something that they should be doing that they're not doing? I understand politics in this part of the world, when it favors Lebanon, it has to line up in a way that's good for Lebanon. And that includes an international understanding and regional dynamics mixed with a Lebanese position that makes sense. I don't see that at the moment, and I'm not sure if I'm being hard on them, but do you feel like certain language is not adding up, certain aspirations are not realistic? Is there something that they should be doing that they're not doing, simply?
It's a good question. So they're in a tough position. As you just came from Pascal's, funeral. Last August, another LF official was murdered by Hezbollah as well. When you talk, Lokman was talking about the port, and about Hezbollah's role in siphoning off the ammonium nitrate to give to the Syrians. Your dad was talking about getting Iran out of Lebanese politics. And then the killing machine goes into action. And so there's limitations. I mean, people, are very brave, and yet there's, there's only so far oftentimes they can go. And so I think, talking about Hezbollah, talking about peace, about 1701, good relations with the West, I think there's more that can be said about the economy and economic reform, because of course with Cardinal Hassan, Hezbollah is profiting greatly off the lack, the failure of Lebanese banking system, and the impoverishment of the Lebanese population. They're doing just fine, thank you. They're very comfortable with this economy the way it is. I think also more engagement with the Gulf states. Now, it's going to be incredibly difficult to entice states that invested so much on the right side in Lebanon in favor of, just money, with money, bad money after bad money, and no results. And not a whole lot less corruption from the good guys than from the bad guys, and the good guys making deals, the quipartite agreement with Hezbollah right after the 2005 elections, after self-inflicted wounds, going along to get along, I think it's important that these people are principled, but you need to get your allies in shape. Just one final thing, a comment on the developments of the day, if I might. I see really, I know how many Lebanese feel about Syrian refugees. And I really do see little reason to blame what happened on Syrian refugees. These people, some are go back and forth, to be sure. Most of them have fled the Assad regime and fear going back, being conscripted, being murdered, being imprisoned. They didn't kill Haskell. I think we should be focused on who the murderers are and not, not grab onto the shiny item that the murderers want us to grab onto. We saw Nasrallah's statement saying that the Kuwait and Sami Jamayo are going to civil war. Just because they talk about an assassination being perpetrated by Hezbollah is going to civil war, isn't the assassination the root problem? So I think we should be, focused and careful as we can be in our language. I mean, but yeah, the opposition in any event has a tough road to hoe.
Could I just press a little further on the let's say, lack of outreach to Gulf states among Lebanese actors right now that share at least enough interest in some kind of stability that's not bad for Lebanon? I agree with what you said earlier, that there are certain countries, at least in recent memory, that prefer stabilization without resolution. And that does kill off the aspirations for a better country long term. And I share that sentiment fully. But does that mean, to just entertain this idea further, that there should be more diplomacy by Lebanese actors, that they're not doing the outreach that's necessary? That to me, the reason it sounds so unavailable, let's say, is that Lebanon has been absent from diplomacy for many, many years. Is that something that they need to inherit, or at least take that mantle and prove that they have at least the interest to do so? It doesn't mean it necessarily represents the state, but it represents a political aspiration. Is that the kind of scenario you're at least suggesting?
Yeah, I think there are people of stature in the country, and I'm not talking about the foreign minister who doesn't represent the kind of people that we're talking about here.
Yeah.
People that have a very different vision for Lebanon. And let's caution again, we don't want another Doha Accords.
Right.
I mean, this was the logical result of, the Hezbollah's invasion of Beirut and the shooting up of Raytem, and so there was a negotiation where, basically a forced surrender of the majority to give the minority, a minority or a plurality, permanent control over Lebanese politics.
Yeah.
And this, to my mind, I'm not, on the anniversary of your civil war, I'm not rooting for another civil war, but neither can you, accept total surrender, as Lokman would say.
But I do agree with you on the lack of proactive diplomacy. And that could also include, and I'll take a little bit more of your time.
Yeah.
The lack of creative solutions. I do sense that there's a need for at least some measure of track two diplomacy, where there should be some communication that's not necessarily designed to preserve the status quo, but to get out of the status quo. I don't see any curiosity there by all sides. That includes the Americans too. Am I reading that?
Yep. A lot of it historically has been people coming to Washington and saying, save us. Tell us what we can do to help you, but you have to help yourselves. I mean, that's been a perennial issue.
Yeah, it's well said. Just a final question, and with your permission, I got to know you through my father, and I know that it was more professional than anything, but I did sense in those conversations that there was a blend of professionalism with friendship too. It seemed like the conversations you had, you both got along and wanted to talk more. Is there anything you remember, just it could even be anecdotal, of talking to him about Lebanon during the middle of a crisis, and maybe even something that you took away from him, the way he was thinking about this country, or maybe even the way he saw American policy towards Lebanon? Is there anything that you remember that sort of sticks out?
Well, I mean, your father was unique in many ways. One of which was he didn't despair, right? I mean, he saw a problem, he'd think it over and come up with sort of analytical solution that, hey, maybe the United States could do this. Maybe we could do this. Here's where it could work together. I think he was a real problem solver, but he also had, amazing breadth of knowledge, not only about Lebanon. I mean, we loved Lebanon dearly, and I mean, just knew economy, diplomacy, history of the country, but also knew as a region. I think he's a guy that your country could use a whole lot more people like him. And I'm sad to say, and I said it at the time, when I learned of your father's assassination, they killed him for a reason. Because he was one of the most effective advisors, had some of the clearest insight on where to go. And I just really enjoyed talking with him, and your mom as well, by the way. I mean, also lo lovely lady. I met your aunt. I mean, yeah, you got a great family,
Well, thank you,
really.
David. I appreciate that, actually. I'm glad for that reason and other reasons. I'm glad that he's in the background of this conversation too. David Schenker, I really appreciate it. This actually means a lot to me. I've been wanting to talk to you for years now, and we finally get the chance to do it. So thank you,
Well,
good man.
thanks for having me, Ronnie. It's a pleasure.